Accession number 18505, Reel 3.
Jim Porter, Reel 3.
For some reason, I don't really know, but I just didn't fit in with his ideas of things. Anything I did was unpopular with him.
So did you apply for a transfer?
No, I wasn't. It would take more than that to let me boil, or to let him, or to show it to him that he was getting somewhere. The type of man, we went to briefing for a raid. I don't know where the raid was, but it was my last raid from 10 Squadron. And the crew, we were all sitting around the table, and he walked up, and he said, "Oh," he said, "by the way, you know you're posted, don't you?" I said, "No." "Oh," he said, "I forget where it is you're going," but he said, "You're posted." That was the leadership that your squadron leader was giving you. It's setting you off on a mission with your mind upset. But justice was done, because before I left the squadron, I was told it was going that night, and the next night there was another raid on, and he went, and he didn't come back.
So you got posted to where?
I got posted to 635 Squadron, which was at Downham Market.
And this was Pathfinder Force?
That was Pathfinder Force. I went through the Pathfinder School.
What was the Pathfinder School like?
It was just the finer points of navigation. The head of the Pathfinder Force was DCT Bennett, as you probably well know. He was a pilot, British Overseas Airways, I think it was called in those days, but pre-war. He strongly believed that the most important thing in a crew was a navigator. Working out the courses, working out the wind drift, things like this. And that was what he set up his Pathfinder Force on, navigation. And it worked. The main force of the bomber command, the raid would last 20 minutes. There would be five waves, as it was called, and they overlapped by a minute. So wave number two would come in on the fourth minute, and number one would, carry on for 5 minutes, and they sort of overlap that 1 minute. But the pathfinders, they dropped markers. The markers burned for 3 minutes. And you had three aircraft that were detailed to be on target at a specific time to the minute. And so that if you lost one on the way, you know, if number one dropped his markers and number two didn't make it, then number three would still have a marker to bomb. You see, that was the theory of the overlap. You see, one and three, and it worked. The only thing which made it difficult was the fact that the smoke from the fires travelled with the wind, and the aiming point always moved upwind. And any of those that fell short were covered with the smoke. Any of them that were downwind were covered by the smoke. But all the rest of them, I didn't know of any, whether on targets were hit or anything like that.
Did you ever meet Don Bennett?
No. No, I never met him as a person. Heard a lot about him, but I didn't know him.
Now, you said this was at Downham Market. Was this with Halifax's or Lancaster's?
Lancaster's.
And your first raid with them was with Cat Green there. Do you remember that one?
Yeah. Cap Greenay was a jamming station for the G box used in navigation. And in daylight, it just looked like a large area covered with aerials. And we had to fly to a fixed point on the channel, English Channel, using G. And at that stage, the jamming from Cap Greenay would be beginning to come in. You would be beginning to see the fuzz on the line on your scope. We were all given then from that point a course and distance run. In other words, I would be heading, say, southeast, and so many miles, or so many nautical miles, and then you dropped your bomb, or bombs. And the bombs were mainly delayed action. About three quarters delayed action and a quarter high explosive. And on the way home from that, because you only just cut across that little piece that sticks out into the channel from France, G was full strength. So, you know, that was it didn't need anybody, or it didn't need any photographs or anything for us to tell that we'd put that jamming station out of action, because we had the picture on the scope to tell us. And that was not very long. That wasn't very long before D-Day, was it?
Well, it was the spring of 1944. You haven't actually got the dates in your book.
That's because yes, and it was shot down before.
You were shot down on May the 22nd, I think.
Yes, May the 22nd.
This was a raid on Duisburg.
Duisburg.
Can you tell me what happened?
It was quite uneventful until, on the way home, the navigator suddenly said to me, we're 2 minutes early and we're only 2 minutes from the coast. And it's a quick decision whether you were going to try and get out quickly, or whether you were going to try and waste that 2 minutes. And before I even had time to really think about it, I was hit by a couple of fighters.
Did you see them?
No, only saw the flashes, the cannon. Took the inner port inner engine completely out the wing. Fire in the wing. Fire further down aft, as the tanks were blown open, and it went down. The fire drifted down with the fuel, and then it blew up. And I went up through the roof, complete with seat strapped in. I can remember saying, "Ooh, I'm out," you know. And I reached for the D-ring for the parachute to pull it. I found a buckle and pulled it. And just then, something came up my back, which was later fixed as my seat, my oxygen mask, my microphone, my helmet, and the whole lot was all pulled off. Then I went again to find the D-ring and pulled it. I found it and pulled it. And all of a sudden, there's silence. I've never heard silence like it before. Absolute silence. Not even a breath of wind. And I must have been, at that stage, 20,000 feet. Drifted down, landed in a field. Sorted out my Pandora's box and my maps and things, but I wasn't able to find out on the maps, the silk maps. I couldn't place myself on them. at that stage. And I was just wandering loosely around, and it came across an old dilapidated factory. I was going to see if I could hide in there for the night, but it didn't. It didn't seem clean enough. There was too many spiders and bugs and creepy crawlies around. And I moved on. And I found that I heard German voices. So it was obvious I was coming to a German roadblock. And there was a house close by. I went round the back of the house, and they had an air raid shelter in the back garden. This is one that on the continent where they dig themselves down into the ground and put bracken and stuff like that over the top. And I went in there and thought, oh, I could see the sun was coming up. And I lay down, went to sleep, but wakened up. I didn't sleep very long. And I wakened up somewhere around about 12 o'clock. And I went and had a look out of the doorway, and there was a woman hanging her washing out in the line. I just moved back in again, sat down, and then an hour or so afterwards I heard a lot of chattering and that, and the woman came down and she'd brought the priest. And he spoke Flemish. I spoke a bit of French in those days, but I was in the Flemish speaking area. And he then produced a photograph and showed it to me and told me that at 6 o'clock I had to go into the woods at the bottom of the garden and I would see this man and he would take me. But the house attached to the air raid shelter was not safe because the Germans came. And I went, 6 o'clock I went, and I met this chap, and he guided me through a bit of woodland and across what had been woodland and been chopped down, and took me to a house. And that was the house of the Arts family, A-E-R-T-S. And I lived in that house with the Arts family for about a month.
Where was this place?
Eltenbosch 17, Lommel. In the province of Limburg, in Belgium.
Were they connected with the resistance in any way?
Their son was. Gustav. Gustav is one of those on the photograph that I showed you, Gustav and Sophie, his wife. That was taken when they were over here. I don't remember the year, which particularly year it was. But Gustav was same age as me. He was unmarried at the time. And the father and mother's, his father and mother's name, I don't know. They were Mama and Papa, as far as I'm concerned. Mama and Papa. And then there were other people connected with the underground that came in, used to play cards with me of a night. They got me a civvy suit. They got me an identity card. Of course, we took photographs with us, as you probably realise. We had passport photographs. And they kept me, they fed me, they hid me. And I was there for a month. They brought people from the underground. I think they were from Holland to verify that I was English and not a plant. And also to see whether or not I wanted to stay there or go home. And they offered, you see, the choice. Now, at that stage, the landing in Normandy had started. And it was a hard decision to say, I'll stay. So I said, no, if you don't mind, I'll go. And they said, all right. And then they arranged for me to travel to Hoboken, just outside of Antwerp, on the train, and Papa was to go one station down the line and buy the ticket. And whenever the train came in, he was to get off and give me his ticket. And I was to get on. And there was a courier in the compartment, a bloke from Holland, with a big moustache, and another British airman, Canadian airman, a fellow called Johnny Elsliger, French-Canadian. He was in the compartment there with him. We went walking along the platform, and they all met people that shaking hands with people that you knew, and we were just standing there like two dummies. And then eventually somebody came up a Belgian accent with an American twang, just said, "From now on, gentlemen, follow me." And he took us to a cafe opposite to Harmony Park. And the cafe is named by translation was the Green Peacock. We only had a cup of coffee and that there, and we were taken down into the basement. A wall between that and the adjoining property had been demolished, and we were then brought up into the shop next door, which was a bookshop, newspaper shop. And when she closed the door, or the woman that owned the shop closed the door for lunch, we were taken upstairs very quickly. And we stayed there 2 days. There was an Englishman there. No idea who he was, but he was definitely English from his accent. You can always tell, you know, the odd word even in the best spoken people from a foreign with a foreign accent. He was word perfect. Educated at Oxford, he said. He showed us what he claimed was a radio receiver transmitter used by the British. Right or wrong, I don't know. And we, Johnny Elsliger and myself, we were given a room, a bed, and we weren't happy about this setup. We were saying, I wonder if we should do a runner. You see, but there was a curfew on, and we said, we'll think about it. And we were thinking about it, talking about it. Following day, while we were still, we were getting close to the stage of saying, if this fellow would disappear out of the way for a minute, we'd be gone. A chap came in and said, get your things, you're moving on. And he had the little ribbon that nearly all the Belgians, or the loyal Belgians, wore, the colours of the Belgian flag. There were a very small ribbon there. He took us out the shop, along the road, turned a corner, and handed us over to another courier. And he walked us a few yards